Do you still keep in touch with any of the guys that you grew up with?
There's a handful of them.
Mm-hmm. Are you guys tight? Like, you get together and no time's gone by kind of thing?
Yeah, pretty much.
I don't know. Guys are really good about that kind of thing, I think. Yeah. James Murray is kind of like that. He still hangs out with, and he works with, three guys that he went to high school with. They call him Murr. You know who I'm talking about now. Murr and his three guys are behind a show on True TV called Impractical Jokers. It's described as reverse improv, kind of stealth comedy. It's a hidden camera show where one of the guys is being told through an earpiece by the other three guys what to do. Prank type stuff. Totally, like, not mean or, like, rude kind of stuff, but just, like, funny. The funny stuff that the seventh grade boy would do to another one. Smart, funny. So Murr is also a New York Times bestselling author. He writes horror books as well. Huh. I'm this dying to ask why anyone who calls Murr an overnight success is 100% wrong, what he gets from his side job of writing horror novels, and how the Impractical Jokers are actually able to pull off the stunts on the show. I mean, we're going to go deep into, like, what it was like behind the scenes and how they actually do this stuff and why anybody would agree to be on the show.
That sounds exciting.
It's very cool. We're excited to have Murr on Dying to Ask. I'm Deirdre Fitzpatrick, and I am obsessed with knowing how people do things. I write the book, they start the company, they go from idea to reality. I call it the art of the follow-through, and I want to know how people go from A to B. This is the Dying to Ask podcast. Murr, thanks for joining us on the Dying to Ask podcast.
Thank you for having me. This is awesome.
Well, yeah, let me tell you why it's awesome. I have a 13-year-old son who is not impressed by anything that I have done in my career. Like, nothing impresses this kid. But last night, he wanted something, clearly, because he was asking me, well, what are you doing at work these days? I said, oh, I'm interviewing the guy from Impossible Jokers, Murr. And he's like, what? He was dying. Like, you're big with the 13-year-old boys and many other people, too. But he was dying. And he goes, I think this show is getting some credibility.
Dude. That's funny. That's great. Yeah, look. The guys and I are friends since we were 13 years old, and we never grew up.
Yeah.
So we're really big in, like, the teenage community. You know? The immature teenage boy community loves us.
You're huge with them. You know, I love the idea that you guys have been friends for so long. And my husband has a group of guys, 10 guys he's known since he was a little kid as well. What is it about men and friendships that they can sometimes last, like, an entire lifetime? And in your case, you've even built a career with them, too.
I think we went to an all boys Catholic high school in Staten Island. So there was literally nothing to do other than prank each other, you know. So I think that kind of formed and bonded us for life, you know, that kind of camaraderie. And we didn't have the distraction of girls. Once we did, we didn't talk to each other for years. It forms this kind of bond that you just don't get otherwise. And Staten Island, when I grew up in the 80s, is very much like Stranger Things, the TV show. That's exactly what it was like. It's like, you know, you jumped on your bike. You said, Ma, I'll be home. She goes, come home when the sun comes down. That's right. All she cared about. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It was that kind of sheltered, adolescence. And I really value it to this day, like, becoming friends with them like that. And it just formed us for life. And we stayed best friends. We never grew up in a way.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, to this day, Joe is the only one married with kids and has dogs. The rest of us are. Yeah, I still sleep with a blankie. The only thing is that love me, I have three plants and one is kind of dying. So, you know, so,
still pretty good odds.
Yeah. And this, I think our friendship too, reminds people of the friends they had growing up, you know, their best friends they used to do these kind of jokes with and things like that. And I think they kind of connect to our friendship and to our chemistry.
Do you think back then you would have ever, I mean, obviously you never would have, like, pictured anything like Impractical Jokers, but would you have assumed that those are the guys that you would still be hanging out with in your 40s?
It's so funny. It's crazy to think that, like, the guys I met in religion class in high school, like, I now see 12 days a week, you know? It's so crazy to think of it. I mean, I always dreamt of it. Like, you know, the guys and I did improv together in high school. We loved doing comedy together. And we formed our comedy troupe right after college. We always dreamed of doing it, having a TV show. But we never wanted to audition. We didn't want to go that route of the actor and doing that kind of, like, you know, casting director and reading parts. We just didn't feel it was right. So we struggled for, like, 11 years to get a TV show. And we eventually got one. And I remember the proudest moment I ever had was the night of our first premiere, the December 15, 2011. We started filming the TV show 9 years ago at this point. And that night, we stood up there. All our families and friends were there. And the show was premiering on TV. We had, like, a big screen and things like that. And the four of us stood up in a circle, and we kind of all said to each other, this may fail, it may get canceled tomorrow, but this night, tonight, we're on TV. We made it on our own terms. We didn't get discovered. We didn't get cast. Didn't have an uncle in the business. We just worked our butts off for
Which in Staten Island would have come in handy. Most people had an uncle who could have helped you with something, right?
Yeah, you know, I can't believe it. I can't believe it's my life. I'm very blessed every single day that this is my life.
Yeah, and it's amazing the success you guys have had. Sometimes I feel like I read about you and the show, and I'll see people say, you know, like overnight success, and they'll say it like with regards to your writing or with the show, but you're kind of anything but. You've been working your tail off for a really long time.
I'll tell you a funny
time.
Story. We say we're an 11-year overnight success story.
Yeah.
Literally 1 month before we sold Impractical Jokers, our agent sat us down and said, the show's funny, but you guys are too old for TV. Son of a gun.
Wow.
And now we're in season 8. We're about to hit our 200th episode. So he can suck it.
That's right. And you're even older. Let's talk a little bit about your writing, because you've actually been writing the fiction stuff for quite a while, although yeah. People probably didn't realize you were a writer until just the last couple of years. What's the backstory on that?
It's crazy. I mean, I went to Georgetown for writing. You know, I was dreamt of writing thrillers in one day. And I spent 15 years ago, I spent a year. I was unemployed. I spent a year of my life, a full year, writing the first book, Awakened. Awakened's part of a trilogy. The Brink that just came out is part two. I spent a year of my life writing it. This is long before Impractical Jokers. At the end of the year, I sent the book out to every publisher in New York City unsolicited, and they returned it to me unopened. I couldn't get a single person other than my mother and Q to read the book. And they both loved it. But my mom kind of has to love the book, you know? And it sat on my computer for over a decade just collecting dust. And 15 years later, Jokers, our fan base, I sent the exact same book. I didn't change a word into HarperCollins, and they immediately bought the trilogy from
me. Wow.
And then we hit number one on the international bestseller list in Awakened.
That is crazy.
So all those publishers back then, they can suck it too.
Boy, that list is getting longer and longer, Mer.
Yeah. The book is, the trilogy is about the mayor of New York City. In book one, he gets trapped in the subways along with passengers when these kind of subterranean creatures attack. And it becomes like Escape from New York, where the mayor has to save his wife and passengers and get out of the subway system before all hell breaks loose. And he has no clue that there's this secret villain mastermind behind the whole thing. And in book two, The Brink, it picks up where we left off. And the mayor of New York City goes after this villainous character, the secret mastermind. And he tries to take down this villain. And the Brink is... It's written like this fast-paced, action-packed page-turner, like the best summer book reading you ever have. You can't put the book down. Literally, you're like chapter to chapter to chapter, reads that quickly. And it has great characters, heroes versus villains, and heroes on the brink of their own moral codes, and love interests. And there's a couple of homages to Jokers. This the first chapter of the book is a direct reference to Jokers that fans will love. And it's great. It's just kind of great summer beach reading.
You know, you've gotten some really great testimonials. James Rollins, who's a writer actually from our area, absolutely loved it. R.L. Stein of the Goosebumps series said, it's monsters, it's horror, it's fun. Like, that's about as good as it gets for this type of a genre. What's it like all those years later to have that kind of appreciation for something that you worked on so long ago? It must feel amazing.
Yeah, it really is. I mean, if anybody out there is a writer or an actor or what have you, whatever wants to do podcasting or wants to be a radio DJ or, you know, what have you, you know, there's so many barriers to entry. It's so many things, doors closed to you. So to be in a position in my life where I can come up with an idea finally, I mean, it took so long, and feel like I have the means to get it out to the world, and I have a fan base that would like it, assuming it's good.
Which we think it is.
Creatively satisfying it is. You know?
That's cool. Is writing easy for you?
No, I mean, the act of creation is inherently difficult. Mm-hmm. It's so much easier to watch Netflix. It really is. You know? Chinese food and Netflix is very hard to beat.
Yeah, or to tell your buddies in an earpiece what to do on the show. Probably a little bit more fun.
That's easy. I can do that all day.
Right. What's your writing process like? And it's interesting because you now are doing co-writing with a co-author, you know, given your schedule. So what's that all like? How do you work it?
It's actually pretty seamless. You know, Darren is a great guy. He's a best-selling author from the UK. He's a mega Jokers fan. We hit it off immediately.
So. He would have to be, right?
Yeah. and he's a great guy. We riff off each other really well. And that process is pretty seamless. We're writing book three right now. It comes out next June. And, you know, he'll write a chapter or I'll write a chapter. We send it to each other. He usually stays in my guest bedroom for like 2 months at a time, you know. And he's a British guy, so he drinks all my liquor.
It's crazy. Yeah.
So, you know, the process is, you know, we pour a couple shots of Jameson. We get a little loose and we start riffing and scare each other and send chapters back and forth. And it goes like that.
That's awesome. That's awesome. Yeah. And so you have the deals for how many more of these books?
The Awakened is a trilogy. So The Brink is part two of Awakened and part three comes out next June. And then him and I sold another two books, another two thrillers.
Wow.
That you'll hear about very shortly.
Congratulations.
So we're creating this whole kind of thriller horror, company that has lots and lots of books and movies and TV shows based on them.
Who did you grow up reading? Like, who was your inspiration? I'm thinking of like a Stephen King.
Yeah, I'm a huge Michael Crichton fan.
Yeah, Crichton.
He was my favorite. And Dean Koontz I love too for horror. And I love that kind of just... You just get sucked into a book and you can't stop. You know, you read the original Andromeda Strain or Jurassic Park and you just can't stop.
Yeah.
You know? And I love that. And Darren and I love the same kind of movies too. Aliens, Terminator, the original Nightmare on Elm Street, the original Friday the 13th, the original The Ring, Event Horizon, The Descent. These are just iconic movies.
Absolutely. All right. So my 13-year-old son, if he's listening to this, and I sure hope he is at some point, is probably thinking, would you ask him about Joker? So we're going to take a quick break. Quick break. And then when we come back, all things Joker's coming up with Mer after this. Jeff, you know how when you plant a garden, you water it so it will grow?
In theory, yes. I've not done this myself.
Yeah, that's not how podcasts work, though. We need ratings and reviews, so please take a second when this episode finishes and leave us a quick review on Apple iTunes. I read all of them, and whoever ID'd themselves as L3SF and suggested that I slow down a little bit, you were right. So thanks for the feedback. Back to the show. Let's talk about Impractical Jokers. You started it back in 2011, and I've seen it described as reverse candid camera. Is that fair?
it's fair. It's like an upside down hidden camera show where the joke is on us instead of the public. So like we took away we didn't like prank shows. We didn't like that the public has no idea they're being pranked and you feel bad for the person getting pranked. So what we did with Jokers was we took that element away. So the public is just there to witness our embarrassment as we put each other in these crazy, embarrassing situations. And the cool thing about the show is that we're not daredevils. We're not pranksters. We are regular formed guys. And our parents watch a show.
Right.
And I know that if I do something wrong, my mother's going to call me at 10:31 p.m. and say, what did you do? So, man, I don't dare be a gentleman on TV.
Or worse yet, one of the other guy's moms is going to call you and say, what did you do to my kid?
Sal's mom calls me and starts, you know, gives me the business. Forget it.
You don't need the business from Sal's mom. So tell us about, like, technically what it takes. The guy who is the one being told what to do is wearing an earpiece.
Yep.
And so
he's wearing an earpiece in the field on locations. So let's say we're filming at White Castle, right? He's behind the counter. He's wearing the earpiece. The other three of us, his best friends, have to tell him everything he has to say and do. And he can either do it and figure out a way to do it or not do it. And if he refuses and loses too many challenges in an episode, he gets punished at the end in some kind of very personal, embarrassing, horrifying, hysterical way.
And so how do you come up with the pranks and with the scenarios? And what does it take to get a place to agree to allow you guys in?
I usually end up sleeping with the owner in some way. it's funny. When we first started the show, we were literally on the phone calling businesses saying, can we film there? Now, a lot more, it's businesses approach us to say, please film here.
Do they like really?
Yeah, because the show is not mean-spirited. That's
right.
The show has heart. And I think people can sense that we have a fondness and a love for each other. And the show has a lot of heart. And we are gentlemen always. And therefore, it's not bad for a business. It's actually pretty good because we don't – no customer was hurt in the making of the TV show, I promise you.
How much once the joke starts, how much is it – planned out or choreographed, and how much of it is pure winging it with the guys?
I mean, we are an improv group by nature. We started by doing improv in high school and we stayed that way. And the show, as I'm sure comes across very apparently, is heavily improvised because we have no clue who's going to walk into the restaurant or into the store. We've no idea if he's got a giant mustache and we say, hey, mustache, you know, like we're inspired by the situation, by the people coming in, by the scenario. So we think of the challenge idea going into it, and we may pre-think secretly ideas of how to throw each other under the bus, but truly it's an improv show in disguise.
And so when other people, when members of the public end up being in it, do they all have to agree to be on TV afterward? How does that, yeah, I've always wondered, how does that work?
That is the toughest part of the job to this day, because the show is, as you can sense, very real.
Yes.
And, there's nothing scripted or fabricated in the show. And as a result, we have to talk strangers into being on TV, because if you know the show, you can't be on the show. The show doesn't work if we don't feel that kind of twisting inside. So it's as hard to get the release forms afterward now as it was day one. And I got to tell you, people are generally willing to be on the show because you can tell that it's not mean-spirited. You can tell that the guy was not in control of his own destiny, and that's fun to watch. And so we have a really high sign ratio, but sometimes you'll see a blurred face on TV.
Yes.
And those are the people that just weren't having it. You know?
I know. And when I see the blurred face, I'm like, oh, man, you should have just done it. Go with it. It was
a
good one. So what do you ever have any jokes that don't work? Like, do you ever get in a situation where you guys go out and, like, for whatever reason, it just doesn't come together?
It does happen. It has happened in a long time because I think we've gotten better at the show. But we have one idea we've always wanted to do, and none of us have the nerve to do it. It's an idea for a punishment. I literally wrote this idea in the treatment for the show when I pitched it 9 years ago. The idea is this. The loser of the episode has to go to a stranger's wedding, and when they say speak now or forever hold your peace, he's got to stand up, object to the wedding, go into detail why he objects, realize he's at the wrong wedding, apologize, and leave.
That'd be outstanding.
We've never done it.
Well, hang on to it, because that would be absolutely brilliant.
Yeah, like, the bride and groom would have to know, but the whole crowd, their families wouldn't know, the 300 people in the church wouldn't know. Let's do it.
That's great. Will you tell one of my favorites was the one where you had to do the public polygraph in front of your high school? People who haven't seen that, will you tell the backstory on that one? Because this is hilarious.
There's an interesting story here, because the guys told me afterward, the original idea for that punishment was they wanted my mother to administer a polygraph exam to me and ask any questions she wanted. And I was like, oh my God. And thank God she wouldn't do it. She didn't want to be on TV. So then they switched it and took me back to my old high school and brought 1,000 students in the auditorium and all my old teachers and the principal, who's still the same. And they had a guy ask me all these questions.
Now, when you walked in, for people who haven't seen it, you see you up on the stage and you see the machine, and then all of a sudden this, like, curtain goes off, and then you see this entire crowd. Did you know at the time that you were at the high school, or did they blindfold you or something going in?
They blindfolded me the entire time. And so the first thing I see is I'm on some kind of stage with a curtain and a strapped to a lie detector. I had no idea I was in my high school, no idea there was 1,000 students watching, all my old teachers, one of which I had a crush on was there.
She was still there. It was awesome.
Have you ever had intimate thoughts about Senor Alonso, the Spanish teacher? And I was like, oh, and the polygraph's going like this.
Oh my gosh, it's great. So how long do you typically take actually filming one of these?
We film, it takes about a week. You know, we film, there's usually 2 or 3 challenges an episode, and it takes us a day to shoot a challenge, and then one punishment, which we'll shoot on the fourth day. So I'd say about a week to shoot an episode of the TV show.
Has what's been considered funny on the show changed over the years now that you have had so much success? Because as soon as I see you guys walking in, I'm going to assume something's up.
Yeah, you know, the show has changed. It has, because when we created the show, it was much more fast-paced. It was, you know, just one-liner after one-liner after one-liner. That way, as people flip channels, they would immediately see something that made them laugh, and they'd stop. Now, as people have grown to love our characters, we can really play out a scene more. So the show has slowed down a little bit in a good, great way. And also, we've made the show more family-friendly, because I never imagined in a million years that this would become a family co-viewing show, that this is the show that the grandparents, the parents, and the kids all watch together. I always thought it'd be kind of like, you know, heavy-set guys in their 30s and 40s that watch the show, because that's who we were.
Right.
And now to be a family show that the kids watch and the parents watch together with them, I can't believe it. So we've kind of changed the tone of the show a little bit to be – it's still edgy and right on the edge of what's going on in the world in a pure way. But it's It's definitely more family friendly. We're aware that our audience are families that are watching it.
Being a mom of, obviously, as I said, a 13-year-old boy, I can't tell you how rare that is. It's really hard to find something that you guys actually both want to watch together that you can actually both enjoy.
Yeah, it's true. And I think the show reminds people of the old days when you'd come home from work, a hard day of work, you turn on the TV and just wanted to forget all the BS in the world. Mm-hmm. And like, it seems like everybody's at each other's throats now over everything. And our show is like, kind of like this pure island of just happiness, you know, where it's just fun to go back and just laugh at other people being silly and you feel good about yourself. And it's just fun to watch. And it reminds people of those old days, those old shows you used to watch as a family together.
As the show's kind of grown in popularity, have you had struggles maintaining your persona, I guess? Are you recognized as you're doing the pranks ever? Or yeah. Is it always people that don't know?
No, it happens all the time. It's harder to produce a show. But to be perfectly honest, that's a good problem to have.
Absolutely.
It means it's popular. It means we're doing our job right, you know? If nobody recognized us, we would have been canceled a long time ago. Well, that's a good problem to have.
All right, we're going to take another quick break. And when we come back, I want to talk to you a little bit about success and how to take advantage when you have something like Jokers you were mentioning. All of a sudden, people wanted to publish your book right away. So how to know that, you know, you've got something that can maybe launch you to something bigger? We'll talk about that with Murr coming up next. Hey there, quick time out for a favor for your friend Fitz. If you are enjoying this podcast, and I assume you are because you're still listening, right?
Hopefully.
I hope so. Would you leave us a review on Apple Podcasts, please? You can do it straight from the podcast app. Rate us by stars. Heads up, 5 is the best.
5 is the best.
The best.
Our boss
loves the 5. Yeah. Or you can write us a short review on what you like or maybe what you'd like to see in future podcasts. Samir, what would you say is the biggest lesson you've learned about just the concept of success over the last few years?
You know, don't give up. I that's a lot of it, is that there's so many barriers of entry. So many people don't want you to succeed or, you know, close the door on you. And you just have to, if you love something, just keep doing it and getting better and better at it. And don't stop, because most people quit, right? When your competition kind of just fades away over time. And just so we just always believed in that we could, like, why can't we be on TV? Why am I too old for TV? Why can't I be in a TV show with my best friends, you know? And that's a huge lesson I learned. The other thing too is that I learned this a long time ago, especially with the book too, not to let other people limit or define my success for me. Like, why can't I write a thriller, you know? Why can't it be scary? Do I only have to do Impractical Jokers? Why can't Sal tour? Why can't Joe do tons of pet adoption work and charity work? Why can't Q write a graphic novel? We can do all these things. You know, there's Walt Whitman once said, I am large, I contain multitudes, right? Like, life's too short to do one thing. Do everything, right?
I think people, you know, and I don't know if this is just society that kind of pigeonholes them or if it's just the limits we feel on our own time. I think that's a really hard thing for a lot of people.
It is. I think it's you fall into something where you're making some money and you're like, you know what, you just stick with it. And suddenly 10 years have gone by and you're like, oh, my God, I can't believe I still do that for a living. And for me, it was always, you spend so much of your life working, right? You spend like 60, 70 hours a week working and only certain amount of time with your loved ones, family. You better make sure what you're doing for a living. The only currency we have is time, not money. Not love, it's time. That's all we have. So if you're not spending that time with people you love, that build you up, that you love, that you build up, and doing what you love, well, you're wasting your only currency that matters.
And it's interesting because you have also, you've been working in production work for years. So it's not like this is the only thing you were doing. You had another job all these years too.
I was the senior vice president of development for a TV company. My job was to create and sell TV shows. Like I had a good job. And I was making decent money for the first time in my life, and I'd sold a bunch of TV shows, and it could have been. And we had two offers on the table for Jokers: once with MTV, and they wanted the show, but not the four of us. They wanted younger guys. And then the other was True TV, that's wanted both us and the show concept. And we had a real choice: we could have just sold it and collected a check, and hopefully it would last, or we could have taken the giant leap and quit our careers. Q was FDNY for 8 years. He was a fireman, decorated fireman. 3 times by the mayor. Joe was the number one salesman in his company. Sal owned a bar, was a bar owner in New York City. And I was a TV development guy. We had full-time jobs, you know? And it could have been very easy not to take the leap and not to take the risk. But the risk is what it's all about, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's also super inspiring for people who, like you said, have built careers doing one thing, but maybe have these ambitions of doing something completely different. Like, take the leap sometimes. And it doesn't mean you have to, like, get rid of everything else.
I say to my girlfriend all the time, I was like, babe, if I decide to quit Jokers and quit writing, quit everything, quit TV altogether, and I suddenly I become a scarf magician, like I pull scarves out of people's sleeves, and that's what I want to do for a living. Would you still date me? And she always says yes, thankfully.
Can you do that trick?
I'm going to, and what if I then become like wildly famous and rich because of my ability to pull scars out of anything?
What if? So what's next? What else is on that list of things that kind of rattles around your brain that you think,
the season is the 200th episode of Impractical Jokers, which is crazy.
Huge.
The Impractical Jokers, the movie, comes out this year. We just finished filming it. And so we hope to launch a movie franchise. And then we have a new show called The Misery Index starting this fall, starting the four of us on TBS.
That's great.
That'll be on TBS this fall. And then obviously the guys and I tour. We're going to be right there in Sacramento this Friday night. And then more books. I sold two more books other than the Awakened Trilogy, more thrillers. And then I'm out in L.A. this next week pitching Awakened and The Brink as a movie.
I know you have a million things you got to get to today, but I'd love to just know maybe some parting thoughts you have on just friendship and the idea of how to make a friendship last, other than, you know, pranking the hell out of your buddies. but what do you think is the key to making a friendship last all these years?
You know, I'm usually the guy that tears us apart in all our fights. I'm usually center in all the fights that we have. But, you know, I think it's supporting each other, being there for each other. Listening to each other is a lesson I had to learn the hard way because I get so focused on what I want to do that I forget to actually listen to my best friends, and staying real and with each other, being honest with each other is huge. And the other lesson I've learned in life is to treasure your hair as much as you can while you have it. Because as they say, hair today, gone tomorrow.
Gone tomorrow. Murr, it's been just a ton of fun. What's a good way for people to keep in touch with you on social media?
I mean, you can find us everywhere. I'm on Instagram at TheRealMurr, on Facebook and Twitter at James S. Murray. Or you can go to thetenderloins.com, awakenednovel.com. Or impracticaljokers.com. We're easy to find.
And the best place to find the books?
You can go to anywhere books are sold. Amazon, Barnes & Noble, any of your local booksellers. It's on sale right now, The Brink. And it is the best summer beach reading you'll ever have.
I love it.
You don't even need a beach if you don't live near a beach.
Well, that's full service. Well, come on out and do some pranks out in Sacramento. We need to lighten up out here.
We will, I promise.
Good spot. All right, thank you, Murr.
You got it, guys. Thanks for having me.
So going into this one, I kind of expected just lighthearted, laughing, comedic the whole time. Mm-hmm. He got a little deep in the end there.
A little bit, yeah. But I'll tell you what's also interesting about him is a lot of times you talk to a comedian and they have two different sides.
Yeah.
And so they're on when they're on, but then when they're off, they're a little bit more sedate. He's exactly the same all the time. Like what you see on TV is truly what you get, which I think makes Impractical Jokers that much more fun to watch now.
Yeah.
And my kid kind of thinks I'm cool today. So, super fun. Check out his books too. Like when I tell you that, like, it's getting great reviews from people, it really is. If you're into that kind of genre, you're going to love these books. You can check us out on Instagram. You'll find the show at Dying to Ask Podcast. You can keep up with me at Run Read Sip.
I am at Producer Jeff.
And don't forget to leave us those ratings and reviews. It is the fastest way to grow the show, especially on Apple iTunes. Thanks again for listening.
And tell your friends.
All of them.
Bye.